now approaching. Junction at platform. Passengers, airport, please stay on board. Next stop, road station.
iOS helps you control which apps you share your exact location with. There's more to iPhone.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
This is the Game Football Podcast from The Times. Today, there's an All-English Champions League final to look forward to, but what new can we expect from Chelsea versus Manchester City? We'll look ahead to the EFL's final weekend as well. Could Wayne Rooney's Derby County be relegated, and what would that mean for his and the club's future? And as we welcome home fans back to Premier League grounds, does that skew the competition? All that and more coming up on today's episode of The Game. I'm Hugh Wisencroft. To help me through it all, Tom Clark, Gregor Robertson and Jonathan Northcroft. I'm hoping, guys, you are energised after the Champions League games we've had so far this week. How are you?
Very well, thank you, Hugh.
Very well.
Good. Look, English fans or fans of the Premier League have something to look forward to, I imagine. Chelsea and Manchester City go head-to-head in the Champions League final on the 29th of May in Istanbul. We'll talk about whether it should be in Istanbul a little bit later on. But it's the second All-English Champions League final in the past 3 years after Liverpool met Spurs in 2019. So much for us to discuss. Let's talk about the performances first. Let's talk Chelsea. Gregor, it was a fantastic win, another great performance against Real Madrid. It almost showed a golf in class. What did you think?
Yeah, absolutely. I think Real Madrid looked old, tired, just past it. I think they had five or six players over 30. They're in trouble, really, I think. A lot of players look like they're kind of on their last legs and they need an overhaul and they're £1 billion in debt, so good luck with that. But Chelsea, on the other hand, just looked, you know, young, dynamic, full of energy and, you know, very intelligent in their play as well. We've said it so many times, the balance that Thomas Tuchel has managed to strike up between, you know, that defensive resolve, and I think it's 18 clean sheets now, which is astonishing in his time. And I think they're the best team probably in the league now, kind of just breaking the lines and springing attacks so quickly. And Kante seems to be the instigator of a lot of them. He's, you know, we think Kante going around kind of mopping up, cleaning up other people's messes, but he's actually, Tuchel's kind of allowed him to be the man who nicks in front of someone, and as we saw for both goals, in fact, kind of springs attacks. So many good performances as well. I thought Silva as well at the back, the only time, you know, any balls are launched in the box, he was a towering presence. Havertz has kind of grown in strength, and Werner, despite his troubles in front of goal, you know, he provides that kind of that threat in behind, and full of energy too. So I think there's so much for Chelsea fans to be hopeful for in the under Tuchel now.
Jonathan Tuchel becomes the first manager to reach back-to-back finals in the European Cup, in fact, with different teams in consecutive seasons. Our friend Matt Dickinson believes his clarity announced means Chelsea cannot fear City in the final. What do you think he means by that?
Well, I first of all, I think Matt's right. And I think what he means is that you know, Tuchel is a man with the ability to neutralise any team. I think we've seen that since he took over at Chelsea. They've been the hardest team in the league to play against. Manchester City were, you know, kind of basically disarmed and as I say, neutered when they played them in the semi-final of the FA Cup. I know it wasn't a full City side. Apart from that crazy game against West Brom, I mean, sides haven't really left a scratch on Chelsea. And he's a great communicator, a very bright thinker. You could tell, I think, by watching PSG's performance and the disarray they were in. In hindsight, the impact that he had on organising that collection of stars. And he's done the same with Chelsea. He's arrived, you know, you sort of forget the kind of, I wouldn't say mess that Lampard presided over, but there was a lack of clarity in Lampard's time when he couldn't make sense of where to put all these signings. And now Tuchel has brought a system that makes sense of the resources that he's got. I mean, he can slot players in and out, but it's just so well balanced. You know, football at the moment is so much about positional play and covering the pitch. The thing I notice about Chelsea is when they don't have the ball, they've just always got players in the right area of the pitch to stop you. Gregor mentioned Thiago Silva. I think he's huge in that, the way he reads the game at the back. You've got to talk about Kante and his ability to just cover so much ground, not just by his energy, but his football IQ is off the scale. But Jorginho is such a strategic footballer. Then you've got the front three that press like nobody else. And you've got a very good sweeper keeper, you know, one of the bargains of the season. I think Mendy's overlooked in his contribution. And I don't know, they're like playing Stephen Hendry at snooker. You know, they're just so hard to kind of dispose of, Chelsea. If they could score goals, if they could put teams away, you'd be looking at them saying, you know, wow, they're on Man City's level. It's probably just that factor that makes them a slight notch below. But in this game, in this one-off game, I think I've said it on this podcast before, I put Chelsea as slight favourites.
Big, big call. We'll talk about the final in a few moments' time. It is the third final Chelsea have reached, having sacked their manager mid-season in the Champions League. It's not meant to be this easy, is it, Tom?
Well, Thomas Tuchel would definitely say it's not easy. It's been incredibly difficult, and he's done a very, very, very difficult job. But of course, he's making it look easy because they're in two finals with the FA Cup as well. One thing I thought was interesting in the players that Johnny was talking about then and reflecting on Lampard's time was that a lot of the discussion around Frank Lampard was couched in all these exciting young attacking players that he'd signed and how can he fit them in and how can he get the best out of Havertz and everything else. And with Tuchel, we find ourselves highlighting that he's found a perfect role for N'Golo Kante. He's got the defence right. Cesar Azpilicueta is a brilliant and vital cog in their machine at the back. And we're talking about completely different players, but that gives them the foundation now. And it then takes away the pressure on the likes of Havertz and people like that, Pulisic, and he can then rotate them up front. And that then becomes a strength. I found myself watching their recent games going, God, they're blessed with so much attacking options off the bench. He can start with Havertz and Werner, and if they're not working, then he can bring on the likes of Pulisic and Ziyech and things like that. So I think that's very pertinent, and Johnny highlighted it in the players that he picked out and in Gregor's constant analysis of how good Kovacic and Kante have been. But I don't think it is easy. I think it's been a lot of hard work, and we've talked about what a detail-orientated manager he is. But I also think that it's a very shrewd appointment by Chelsea, because when you think back to the Di Matteos and the Avram Grants, they were almost the Lampard style appointment, i.e. we'll give this guy a go and see how he gets on. And they obviously did brilliantly and got them to a final, and Di Matteo obviously won it. Whereas Tuchel, it felt like this guy is one of the best coaches in Europe. We're in a position where we're still in cup competitions. There's every chance he will get us to the finals, and he's delivered.
Let's talk about Manchester City. I think it's been fantastic from Chelsea, but their manager, Pep Guardiola, has been there for 5 years. And of course, had always had this hanging over him. You know, will he get back to a Champions League final? Will he win another one after his time with Barcelona? Of course, he didn't do it in Germany when he was managing Bayern Munich. And of course, that question had been over Manchester City as a club as well, because we know the club's hierarchy are all about getting to this promised land of the Champions League final. Manchester City breezed past PSG. It was another ominous sign, by the way, to the rest of Europe, the same as Chelsea, I think, around where things might be going in terms of winning the Champions League in the future. Again, another thing we can discuss in a moment. But to the game, the false nines worked perfectly. And as a real critic of them, I thought I might as well bring it up. Riyad Mahrez, impressive again. And he was a main recipient of some of the great performances as well. And as I say, the Abu Dhabi group finally getting their wish as well. Tom, what did you make of Manchester City's performance, particularly in those forward areas?
I think they were excellent. And what was interesting and for me, and when you reflect on City under Pep in these big games, and you, Hugh, have alluded to it many times in the past with him overthinking and, you know, suggestions that they might bottle it. is that they look just completely assured. They look completely calm, comfortable. There was no real sense of panic, I didn't think, in their performances. They looked like a team who knew exactly what they were doing and looked very, very confident about reaching the final. I think that was very telling when you think back to some of those Champions League games where they've lost and they've been knocked out and we found ourselves questioning Pep and his tactics. So I think that bodes very well for City, in contrast to Johnny's point about how good Chelsea are and how well set up they are. City feel like, you know, without wanting to get too much into this is their destiny, this is their moment, but they feel like a team ready for this now. They look like a team very assured of their place at the top of the European tree. I thought that was the most telling thing, as much as the tactics of which have been brilliant this season by Pep. I was speaking to a friend of mine who just very eloquently said, it's shown that Pep really is the nuts when it comes to football tactics. And he's right. You know, we've forgotten that, I think, in the last few years. And, you know, modern day football, I find, particularly for tactical geeks like me, is as much about looking at players and going, wow, he's amazing. But sometimes these top managers, when they come up with these tactics and systems and you're watching going, what on earth is going on here? And it's just fantastic to watch some of the things that Pep's done this season. But I think the mentality side was the thing that stood out for me.
The thing that stood out for me is the same thing as it stood out for with Chelsea, is that balance that they have now, which they haven't in the past, you know, whether it be the threat behind the counter-attack, or, you know, they seem to have shifted the balance in midfield a little bit this year, a little bit more to kind of protect the defence as well. So, and also there was many times, particularly in the second half, where they basically were playing 4-4-2 and getting behind the ball. They, you know, it's not the thing you'd normally. You've seen the City do that a few times in the past, but it's not really the thing you associate with them. And then they're kind of very targeted press. That's the balance that they both have. They kind of, you can see them being, you know, very much a target areas of the pitch where they go and they hound after the opposition press and try and nick the ball and get those turnovers high up the pitch. But then they're willing to just sit off and invite the opposition to try and break through them. And they very often have been found wanting doing so. We can come to Ruben Dias, and, you know, the guy's an absolute magnet. You know, every shot he was finding his face in the front of it or whatever, he's been a colossus. But apart, you know, beyond that, he's such a presence as well. You can see, we've spoken about how much he's elevated, it seems to have elevated John Stones' play. So his presence has been huge, but there is more to it than that, I think. I think the balance kind of tactically between, you know, all-out high press and sitting in a bit, I think that's a big reason why they've got to the final. They've only conceded 4 goals in 12 Champions League games.
Defence is king.
Defence is king. Who'd have thought it? I think, you know, we're seeing a resurgence.
All this excitement, all this forward pressing, get on the attack, lads, and we're sitting here going Azpilicueta, Thiago Silva, N'Golo Kante, Ruben Dias, these guys are the real deal, these guys are the ones. But it's true. Gregor, you're eloquently talking about balance, and you're right, these teams do have a great, vast attacking threat. But we are talking about teams that are in control, and they're in control because tactically they're bloody difficult to beat, let's be honest. So it's going to be 0-0 in the final, is where we're heading.
It's an interesting one with Pep, because I was speaking to a coach yesterday, and he said the same that you hear a lot in the coaching fraternity say about Guardiola, and yes, he is the nuts tactically, and yes, he's respected for the ideas, the innovations that he's brought. But I think one of the real coaching purists look at is just the work rate that he manages to achieve in his teams from sensationally talented footballers. I think they look at that and think, how can a manager have all those ideas and all that kind of coaching intellect and also be able to do the old stuff, as in the pressing, as in the, you know, the defensive blocks, as in the full commitment that, you know, when he came to English football, he was seen as not being able to inspire that side of it. And that, I think coaching's as much about teaching as it is about the ideas you've got. You know, you can have the best ideas in the world, but if you can't actually transmit them to footballers, it's useless. And we're talking about Tuchel's clarity. I think that's one of his assets. But the way that Guardiola can get inside players' heads and get them to do the sometimes complex things that he wants, but also get them to do the basic things that he needs. I look at someone like Riyad Mahrez and his evolution, you know, at the age of around about 30, evolving as a player because he's being taught, he's being coached, he's being inspired on a daily basis. And that's, reasons I love this final is the clash of these two coaches. These two guys can do everything, and we're going to see them, head to head as much as we're going to see these two teams. That's what makes it wonderful.
Well, I'll pick you up on that in a few moments.
I know we differ on
the excitement about this final, but I did want to talk to you about Manchester City, because it's a dramatic scene right now for everyone in football. You know, this is that moment in James Bond where there's a fight and the gun goes flying across the floor and they're both reaching out for it, fingertips, and it just feels like, you know, Popeye just before he gets his spinach, you know, if he only gets his hands on it, it's going to be hell to pay for everyone else. You know, get the kryptonite away from Superman and then just wait and see what happens. It does feel like this might be the moment that Manchester City have just got their fingertips on the weapon. They've got the recipe, and it could be a long, long time, particularly if Pep Guardiola stays at the club, I believe, that they dominate, not just domestically, but in European football as well. And they spent over £1 billion during the time the Abu Dhabi group has been owners on players alone. So I wondered how remarkable, really, you thought their trip to a first Champions League final is.
I think it's enormous, even if they don't win the final, because this is it. This is the stage that they've been aspiring to. And, you know, if they don't win, I think they'll be back next year or the year after. I think just the getting there is the barrier that they needed to break. And if you think about Chelsea, they got there finally after a lot of heartache in 2008. And then they got their hearts broken again. But that was a springboard to then a decade of getting to European finals, decade and more. And I think this is a fourth or fifth in those 12 years. And I think City are still evolving under Guardiola. If they don't win, they'll be back. I think the era of their dominance, I think we're living in it already. You know, it's amazing that Liverpool title already seems, I'm not going to say an anomaly, it's not, but it already seems like a slight blip in the Guardiola era, because if you look at two previous seasons of 100 points, this season of a treble, actually last season was just a bit of a blip for them. So I think we're in this era of dominance, and I don't think they're going away. I don't think now that he's staying, he's going away with this evolution that he's inspiring. If Chelsea actually stick with Tuchel, though, I think this could be a matchup we'll see over the next few years. This could be a rivalry that's got legs. And if Tuchel does stay, then Guardiola won't entirely have it all his own way.
The Chelsea are not far off. No. It's remarkable their progression under him. And you'd say like a centre-half, and you're tempted to say a number nine. But of course, this is going to be the number nine-less derby probably. Final, sorry. but that's the two areas of the pitch you would look at Chelsea. Everything else, they are fully stocked. Like, so many options in attack, options on the flanks, like three, Kante, Jorginho, Kovacic, one of them sitting out, and they're all brilliant. Like, this really is a centre-half, or maybe two. And as I say, if they're going to be playing with a number nine, a kind of really world-class number nine, and you got to say that Chelsea are going toe-to-toe with Manchester City next season.
It's going to be massive. It's going to happen this weekend. It's going to happen in the Champions League final as well. I mean, who doesn't want to see these two teams play four times in one season, Jonathan? You know,
it sounds like you don't want to happen, Hugh. Do you want to get it off your chest? Come on.
No, do you know? I'm so disappointed by Real Madrid and PSG's performances in the semi-finals that it doesn't feel, sometimes you get a game on the way to the final or a couple of ties on the way to the final that you feel were worthy of a final. And so it doesn't really matter that it wasn't the final itself. And I don't think we got that in the Champions League this year. And that was the major disappointment, because one of the other things about the Champions League that I love is you have the sense of it being, you know, the best teams in Europe. And look, all the reasons that people didn't want the European Super League. Firstly, do you really want to see these teams play each other all the time regularly? Doesn't it get a bit boring? Probably, yes. But the other thing is, do you want to see, you know, two teams from across Europe who never get to play? You know, that's what I wanted to see. And to be honest, PSG and Real Madrid were not fitting finalists. Neither of them were up to the task. It would have been great if Robert Lewandowski was fit, though, because Bayern, I believe, would have absolutely smashed PSG if he was. And then that would have been a great semi-final for City to play Bayern, and then maybe I would feel a little bit better about it. All I'm not excited about this Champions League final. That's all I'm going to say. It's not that it's going to be a bad game, although it probably will be a bad game. It's going to be low scoring. It's going to be low scoring, I imagine. But again, I think tactically, it's going to be great to watch for all of us that love positioning and tactics and all that stuff. It's going to be great. But the final itself, it did make me wonder about the European Super League and all those protests. You know, the biggest precursor to success in this competition, it seems like it's been underlined, is money once again. So it was almost a case in point for those teams in Italy and Spain to suggest why they do need a European Super League to try and keep up. Because, like I say, it's the second all-English final in three seasons. It might be an all-English final in the Europa League as well, and that would be the second time in three seasons too. If that's going to keep happening, it almost makes the European Super League, you know, more likely, which is one of the reasons as well I was hoping that sort of Real Madrid got through. It's not like I'm in love with any of these clubs either, to be perfectly honest. I wonder, though, and you guys can tell me, for the neutral weather, the fact that it's Manchester City and Chelsea and their financial histories mean that it loses some of the allure for purists at all, traditionalists, I guess.
Purists? What are they?
Purists.
the two teams that they've just beaten are a kind of counterpoint, surely. PSG, you know, this galaxy of stars, but you thought there was times in this, you know, in the last two seasons, you think, you know, they're becoming a bit more of a team, but they're not, and they were still so short in so many departments. I think Marquinhos is the only defender they have who's fit enough for this stage of the Champions League, and that, you know, for a team with their wealth, that's ridiculous. And Real Madrid to look like the way they look now, and the overhaul that they're in need of, whilst being in £1 million of debt, you know, the way these clubs have been run is a pretty reliable, you know, fair counterpoint to the way that Manchester City, despite their wealth and despite the amount of money they've spent, they've been very astutely managed and kind of, you know, led. So, yeah, we can have that discussion, and we will, and we always will. That's always a conversation that's going to go alongside Manchester City's achievements. But, you know, they've got an absolute genius at the helm. They've got a group of some of the most supremely talented players in Europe, but they're all playing, working so hard and playing as a team. They've been run very, very intelligently as well. So purists, there's no such thing as kind of as pure elite European football anymore. We've discussed that, but Manchester City still deserve great credit, I think.
I definitely take your point, Hugh, as a neutral. There was part of me watching that game where I was, the game last night particularly, where I was very disappointed in Madrid in the same way that you were, because as a neutral with the Champions League, you like to see teams that you don't see as much. You like to see players that you don't see week in, week out. But let's be honest, they were poor, as you say, and didn't deserve it. I think when it comes to the money side of things, yes, as Gregor says, we can always talk about it. But one, lots of teams who win the Champions League spend a lot of money. And fine, they might not have the gargantuan finances that Manchester City do, but Liverpool spent 150 million on Van Dijk and Alisson and won the Champions League. All the way back to Manchester United spent a lot of money in 99 and in 2008 on players and won the Champions League. And I think with City, with Pep, there was part of me that was just pleased for them. I know that sounds a bit soft for one of the grumpy men on the game podcast, but I was just pleased for them and for Pep, because I think on the pitch, away from the money, they have offered so much to football, modern football, in the last few years, that I think you're allowed to be pleased and excited about them getting to a final and just forget about the money, I think.
Yeah, I kind of agree with Tom there. And I think you've got to break it down. I mean, there's a subject of sports washing and state ownership of football. You know, you can be uncomfortable about that, and I'm one that is uncomfortable about it, but I think you have to look at that generally and question that as a general point, and not just bring it up when a team reaches a final. You know, I don't think the fact that in a final makes sports watching any more or less acceptable. So my point is to look at Manchester City in the round and ask those questions, but not sort of link it to this. And if you just talk about football, you know, yes, they've got wealth, but they spend the money so well. You know, we're talking about Ruben Dias as a given, but he wasn't a given when they signed him. You know, Edison wasn't a given when they signed Edison. This is a really clever football club. So it is hard, but if you can separate the finances and just look at the football, I think there's so much to admire. And you know, we've seen over the last couple of weeks there's very little to like among ownerships of these elite football clubs anyway. You know, the Glazers have just won the Super Bowl in American football. Does that make the Glazers, you know, good, bad owners? I'm trying to say you've got to separate the sporting achievement side of things and try and look at the other stuff. If you enjoy it as a football spectacle, this is a great final. The most discomforting thing is that these two clubs didn't even want to be in the Champions League. You know, let's maybe talk about that. You know, now then the final, they didn't even want to be in this competition because 2 weeks ago they didn't think it counted.
And the whole thing about, you know, you're saying, Hugh, that the likelihood of a... We can now see why the rest of European clubs wanted to form a Super League, because the dominance of the Premier League. Why on earth would Premier League clubs want to join them when that would kind of even up the scale slightly? That's also bemusing as well. But you know, the other thing is kind of thrown... You know, I don't know, the big conversation recently about reining in the insatiable kind of yearning for continual growth in the Premier League, and we're talking about how we can rein in profit, the desire to profit from football a little bit. And the Premier League is kind of, yeah, everyone says it's the free market, and that's why the Premier League's the best, that's why we can attract the best players and stuff. I just don't really... by that person. I still think that these clubs have been pushed very hard. You look at the German clubs that they've come up against, you know, Borussia Dortmund and Bayern. They run very, very astutely and cleverly. I don't think these clubs need to continually look for growth and profit. I don't think that has to be part of English football.
But they do to win the Premier League, don't they? They probably need to do it more so to win the Premier League than the Champions League at this point. You've got six credible, I think most people would say, Champions League teams in our domestic competition, and I don't think the other leagues can really say that. And it's not just, you know, Manchester United are off and they might get to a Europa League final. Arsenal are a mid-table team, they might get to a Europa League final. You know, Tottenham Hotspur haven't had a great season, but they were, you know, in a Champions League final 2 years ago. You know, the competition in the Premier League is extremely strong. You know, Liverpool have fallen off this season, but they could have been there once again this season in the latter stages of the Champions League, vying for the Premier League title. So it is almost the investment that these clubs are making now is more to do with the Premier League than it is winning the Champions League.
Yeah, that's fair enough, I think. But I still don't think that has to be... You know, it has to continue to grow. That's ultimately what this has all been about. It's like these owners of these football clubs, they're seeing how the extraordinary turnover and amount of money swirling around in the game, and seeing that they're not turning a profit from it. I don't think it needs to continue to grow. That's all I'm saying. The Premier League is in a strong position. It would be in a strong position if there was a little bit less money swirling around in it. And clubs have to find a way, as they have in Germany, to compete. And so I don't, you know. I think that's been an argument that's been used quite a lot over the last couple of weeks since the European Super League, since the protests against the Glazers. I just don't think that this idea that the Premier League has to be this free market, there can't be any more regulation, we can't kind of try and restrict the owners of these football clubs from turning a profit, and that's going to hinder the kind of standard and quality of the spectacle of the Premier League. I'm not buying that at all.
There are a couple of further things I wanted to add before we move on, and we'll talk about the EFL next. Eden Hazard, Real Madrid player, ex-Chelsea, laughing at full-time with his former teammates, has left, you know, onlookers in Spain absolutely raging, saying he should never play for the club again. How ridiculous is this on a scale of 1 to 10, Tom?
I don't know. I quite like going to Madrid, so I don't want to be banned from ever visiting in the future. So, look, they're very passionate about their football, aren't they? They're very passionate about this competition, to give a political answer.
There's always a scapegoat.
There is always a scapegoat, but that there is. And it's often tends to be one of their signings, curiously, often from the Premier League sometimes. when you think over the years down the past, some of their English players that they've signed. It's definitely ridiculous. I mean, I saw a clip on Twitter. I don't speak Spanish well enough to understand any of what was being said, but the tone was incredibly serious. I think they had dramatic, like, dum-dum music, and the presenter was just staring straight down the camera. I think he was saying 2 years of absolute rubbish from this guy, basically. It's very dramatic, but look, they take this competition very seriously, and there's always a scapegoat. And to be fair, he hasn't been great. He's struggled with injuries, and he arrived as one of the best players in Europe, superb for Chelsea, and he hasn't produced. So while I'm not condoning the Amdram reaction to him having a laugh with some of his former teammates, there is an element of why they would pick Hazard as the scapegoat, because he's been very poor, let's be honest, while struggling with injuries since he signed for them.
I don't think it's ridiculous.
Go on.
I just think there are things that are not done in football. Yeah. I know that's like an old school kind of, what's the difference? They've already lost the game. He's seeing his friends. You know that supporters back home are not going to like you seeing laughing on the pitch afterwards. I think it was a pretty daft thing to do. I don't think it's like crime of the century, but I think he was daft to do it there. The only thing I would say is, you know, you can do it down the tunnel. Maybe you can't do that now, actually, because of COVID. I think they were getting changed in like a health club joined on to the stadium. So yeah, maybe you couldn't do that this time. And as I say, it's not the crime of the century, but there are just things that are like unwritten rules in football as players. And one of them is definitely that.
I did think it was a small insight into Hazard's character, actually. You know, you do want to see him hurt a little bit more after an exit and a performance personally that he gave. He's such a sensationally talented footballer, and we've spent his career just waiting for him to take that final step to become one of the real best in the world. And he's never done it. And I think maybe like Gareth Bale, he's just a bit too nice, too laid back, too much of a kind of happy guy. And I think you saw that. You know, I can't imagine Cristiano Ronaldo or even Thomas Muller or something being as jovial after a disastrous game like that.
I don't think it matters how he played. I think he could have scored a hat-trick, and it's the fact that they lost. That's all that matters. They lost the game, and he's laughing on the pitch with one of his former teammates afterwards. I don't think it's a good look.
Harsh.
Sorry if I seem like the old dinosaur in the room now.
don't ruin it, Hugh. Don't ruin it. The game podcast Madrid tour is still very much on. Don't spoil it now.
One final question on this. Two English clubs in the Champions League final at the end of May. It is currently due to be held in Istanbul. Turkey is in a lockdown due to COVID-19 restrictions. Should the final be moved to England? What do we think? Tom?
Probably yes. Will they do it? No. They'll wait until about a week before and then come up with some half-assed, you know, go between and play it in France or something and do no one any favours. There you go.
Jonathan, there is a travel element. There could be 4,000 fans from each club.
I'm torn on this because I know common sense says England, but then, you know, the other part of me says when about 2 months ago, the English were saying the Euros should just be held in England because of COVID, and now we're saying the Champions League final should just be held in England because of COVID.
Can play it in Scotland if you want, honestly.
Well, we can. Hampden Park could have a walk. No, I mean, I do think it's a kind of English reaction to these things to sort of jump to this play the let's play in England card. There's that little stadium in Budapest that seems to host about 20 Champions League games this year. That's probably where it's headed.
It should be moved, yeah. Let's be honest. I think with the state the world's in, and why would you allow several thousand people to fly across the world for a game of football? I think it should be moved. It could be moved to somewhere in Scotland, or maybe somewhere that's a bit different. I think if it was like, no, seriously, if it's at Wembley and there's two English teams playing there, it's a bit like a domestic final. I think it should be something slightly other about it. Get it at Hampden, why not?
We'll see exactly where the Champions League final will be held, but it is an all-English final, massive for both Manchester City and Chelsea as well. Could be an all-English final in the Europa League to look forward to, but at this point in time, it seems like there will be 5 English clubs in the Champions League next season as well. Those rules UEFA have working out for the big leagues at the moment, aren't they? Look, up next, we'll talk about the EFL. We'll look ahead to a huge day for Wayne Rooney's Derby County. We'll discuss the returns of fans in the Premier League as well. But remember, if you're enjoying the game podcast, give us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcast from. And make sure you're subscribed to the Times and the Sunday Times as well. Right now, you can get yourself 1 month free. You can get it across all of your devices as well. Just go online, search thetimes.co.uk/thegame to get yourself started.
As you're listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Off Air, the podcast. With Jane Garvey and Fee Glover.
I go to the sink and I have some cheese.
Keep your cheese in the sink.
Doesn't everybody?
Every Monday to Thursday, Jane and Fee keep the microphones on after their Times radio show.
I think if we were to do a Mr. and Mrs.
Oh, no.
Yes. How would that go in the booth?
Badly. It would go very badly.
Unencumbered and off air.
Two tiny women with gobs.
Off Air, the podcast. Now available on the Times radio app.
The final day of the EFL season is just about upon us, and it's D-Day for Derby County boss Wayne Rooney. Anything less than a win versus fellow strugglers Sheffield Wednesday could open the door for Rotherham or Wednesday themselves to survive instead. Derby have one win in their last 14 games. They've lost six straight. It seems the former Manchester United and England captain will soon be out of a job, but he does have a massive game this weekend. It's a huge day for the club, Gregor.
Yeah, I mean, it feels like it's been coming for a while, this, actually, with Derby. They seem always seem to be chaos surrounding them, really, for quite some time, for many reasons, both administrative reasons and kind of on-field or issues with the squad and whatnot. And the thing is that no one would have seen this coming when Wayne Rooney took over. And then he had such a bounce, you know, he had a really good run up until late February, and they've just, the form's fallen off the edge of a cliff. And I think the loss of Bielik in midfield has been enormous for them. I was reading somewhere that I think in the 13 games he's played, they've taken almost half the points. And he was lost at the very end of January to a knee injury for the rest of the season. So his loss has been enormous. And they've had to rely... Derby have got a brilliant academy. Throughout their kind of the chaotic reign of Mel Morris, the owner, the academy has been their shining light, and they've got some brilliant players coming through. But they've had to rely on them so heavily this season. They've had, you know, experienced players like Waghorn, Curtis Davis, Tom Lawrence, they've all been injured parts of the season. And I think on the bench, seven of the nine players against Swansea on Saturday were 20 or younger. So, you know, from where Derby were, they're always cheering for the playoffs, always challenging even for the automatic spots. It's a really chastening kind of fall from grace. And as I say, I feel like it's been coming for a long time for many reasons. There have been legal disputes with former chief executive Sam Rush. They've had so many legal run-ins with the EFL about, they were the first club to sell their stadium to try and circumnavigate sustainability regulations. Still got an ongoing dispute with Richard Keogh after that, you know, remember the kind of drink driving scandal, and he was sacked after that. That's still going to an employment tribunal, could cost them £2 million. There's just always something rumbling on in the background, and this year it's been a takeover. Mel Morris has been trying to sell the club, and there's been a saga throughout the whole season running in the background about a change of ownership, and one takeover fell through just around the turn of the year, and another is reportedly on the brink of falling through again. So very, very worrying times for Derby County, a huge club in the Championship. You know, they're always, in normal times, 30,000 fans there every week, one club city. And yeah, as I say, I just think that they represent a lot of what is mad about the Championship. They gambled. They've thrown Mel Morris through almost, you know, more than £100 million of his fortune at Derby getting the Premier League, and they've fallen short so many times. And everything they've been doing recently is kind of trying to scrape back credibility, I think, or some semblance of normality and you know, steady the ship. And it's all rests on 90 minutes of football. And I would have to say, I'm not hopeful for them. They've taken the lead in three of the last four games and absolutely crumbled and conceded twice in both of them, lost them all. They are very brittle in kind of confidence and, you know, mentality. And as I say, they're a young team. So, yeah, could be looking at a first drop into the League One since, I think, 1986.
Jonathan, do you think Wayne Rooney will stay the manager at Derby County, whether they stay in the Championship or not? And also, you know, you spoke about his desire for people to understand he had a strong football mind and he had this desire to become a coach as well. Did he rush into it now with hindsight?
Possibly. I mean, he was put in a difficult position, I suppose, by being offered the job that he wanted, you know, a job in management at a good football club quite early when he was still a player and at a club, you know, that he believed in because he was part of the staff. So I think it was kind of hard for him to turn it down. And, you know, yes, Wayne does have plenty of ideas, plenty of knowledge that he can, I believe, will be a good manager, can impart, but he's not been able to do any of that. This has been a firefighting job. This has been sort of damage control. You know, he took over when they were rooted to the bottom of the Championship. As Greg has very eloquently sort of described some of the problems that Derby have had over a period of years. I mean, you know, going back to this time a year ago when we were in lockdown, they were right at the sharp end of wage deferrals and negotiations with playing staffs over taking wage cuts because of COVID. And Wayne was the captain, and Wayne was continually having to go to the squad, agree 1 month's wage deferral, and as soon as that was done, start to negotiate over the next. And you know, it was a dispiriting lockdown for all the playing staff there. Then, you know, Koku's reign sort of fell apart, that rooted to the bottom of the Championship. And you've got two ridiculous takeover attempts. And I say ridiculous because you had Zayed International, who had already tried and failed to take over Newcastle and arrived on the scene at Derby, where, you know, people involved in that Newcastle attempt were telling me from the start, this is never going to happen. These guys can't do it. And they wasted a couple of months of uncertainty. I mean, Wayne took over at that point where it looked, you know, Mel Morris believed the takeover was about to happen, you know, in the next two or three days when he sacked Koku. And, you know, that was part of the brochure when Wayne took over. This club's going to be new ownership, lots of money, blah, blah, blah. And it didn't happen. Then you have the Eric Alonso situation where, you know, a month after he becomes the preferred buyer, he's still scrambling around, you know, the stories that he's trying to refinance the stadium and now that's in doubt. And with all of that going on off the pitch, I just think it's been for a young manager who's, you know, basically was a player 3 or 4 months ago, it's just enormously difficult circumstances. And, you know, the madness of the Championship. Look who they're up against in the last day, Sheffield Wednesday. We could go into their lunacy. What you do see is two formerly great football clubs, two clubs that should be arguably Premier League clubs, who are right on the brink and coming head to head. There's a sort of poetic nature to the fact it's these two up against each other, and both of them, the loser just plunges into the abyss.
No bigger advertisement of why we need stricter regulation in English football, because these guys shot for the moon and they fell short, and now they're just scrambling around to try and stay within the rules, to stay within the regulations about spending. And as I say, both clubs sold their stadiums. You know, Alonso was an advisor to Chancery at Sheffield Wednesday until not so long ago. He tried to buy that club. He's someone who, he's like a football agent. I think he's been a promoter. He's, nobody really knows exactly. Yeah, he's still got these pictures where he's standing with his fists up and he's big on social media. He's not, he doesn't strike you as someone who should be buying a kind of old storied club in the Championship. And you don't really know who he's fronting, you know, where the money's coming from, essentially. And still these two clubs are kind of being entangled with them. And it's all because they see the pound signs in the Premier League as well. So everything is derived from shooting for the moon and shooting for the Premier League. And they've fallen short, and they're really struggling now, and they look like they could be falling out the trapdoor.
Just quickly, Gregor, who would it be worse for, do you think, Sheffield Wednesday or Derby to be relegated?
I think Derby, because Chan Siri, although he's proved himself, the Sheffield Wednesday owner, to be a very bad custodian of a football club, I think he's got the money and he'll stick around, and you know, it might be an opportunity to kind of clear the decks and rid themselves of, you know, it was an enormous wage bill. I think he'll stick around to do that. I think just the fact that Mel Morris is really very clearly wants to sell the club, I think it would just throw a lot of Derby's future into even more uncertainty. I think if they go into League One, then obviously who's going to buy them? And he's already spent, as I say, more than £100 million trying to get in the Premier League, and he's fallen out the wrong way instead. So I think Derby would be the team who I'd be most worried for if they were relegated. Also, Sheffield Wednesday, I've done it before. They have been in League One, they've experienced it, and they've come back. And I think in Darren Moore, they've got someone, although he's had his own troubles with I think he's had pneumonia after having COVID. He's someone who's managed in League One as well. Doncaster did very well until he came to Sheffield Wednesday. So I think they'd be better placed. Wayne Rooney in League One? Not so sure.
Well, Wayne Rooney, I don't know, will be in either, to be perfectly frank. It doesn't matter what happens. If he is sacked in his first job, you know, he could have a happy final day managing to keep Derby up, or a very unceremonious final day as their manager taking them out of the Championship. What happens next with his managerial career? Because he would have been seen by Derby County, certainly a bit like Frank Lampard when he came into the job, or at least having that potential. And we saw what Frank Lampard did by going off to Chelsea. Does he get another managerial job quickly after this, Tom, just based on who he is, who he's been in football?
He certainly could with his experience in the game. I was reflecting on all the things the guy said, and I thought it was so telling that when we're analysing Derby's plight, we barely mentioned the football, barely mentioned what's happening on the pitch. And that's what's so difficult in any level of football, but in the Football League, if you've got all the things going on at a club like Wayne Rooney's had to deal with, and if you get on a downward spiral, it's almost impossible to arrest that slide. You've seen it so often with clubs. Sunderland in the last 5-10 years. Once that happens, you can change manager, you can change style. If that rot is set in, if you like, it's so difficult to stop for a manager. And I think it was this exact a group of people that were discussing Rooney taking the job earlier in the season, and we all said what a difficult job it could be for him as his first job, and so it has proved. So whatever happens, I think that he'll have learned a hell of a lot, let's put it that way, about himself and about management and how difficult it is. But there's no doubt that he can bounce back whatever happens, and even maybe he can be the man to take Derby on the fairly long journey to turn around their fortunes.
Philip Cocu won 3 Dutch titles with PSV Eindhoven and was bottom of the league with this sort of mess of a football club. I just think it'd be impossible and ludicrous to judge Wayne Rooney on where Derby are right now. Gareth Southgate got relegated with Middlesbrough. Did that make Gareth Southgate not worthy of another job? I mean, sometimes a football club can be in such a mess it drags you down. I'd certainly give him another job.
Tom was right in that we've not mentioned anything about the football. They're the lowest goal scorers in the league with 33. They've drawn a blank in 21 of their 45 games. Colin Kazan-Richards, who came, you know, much travelled centre forward, I think he's got 8 goals and is their leading goal scorer. That says it all about what Wayne Rooney has had to work with, to be honest. If you can't score goals, you're in big trouble. And then, as I say, their confidence is up from that. I think they know that if they concede, I think also they've only scored more than 2 goals in one game once all season in the league. They're in trouble if they go behind on Saturday.
Just a very, very quick word for the other team that we're not mentioning in all this, Rotherham, who have the quiet chance, while these two big clubs,
indeed,
who've completely ruined themselves, as Gregor says, shooting for the stars, you know, are going to be nervously probably kicking the crap out of each other and hoping for a 1-0 win, Rotherham can quietly go about their business. Once I realised that Manchester City were going to progress the other night, I actually, like a sado, flicked over to watch a bit of Rotherham against Luton, which was 0-0, cracking game, really enjoyed it. but in a very different way to Derby and Sheffield Wednesday, with all the things hanging over them, Rotherham, with Paul Warne, know what they've got to do. They are a club that, if they went down, it wouldn't be a disaster. It wouldn't be, you know, it would be obviously very sad, but they did very well to get promoted. They can quietly go about their business and pick up a win, while these two teams scrap it out and probably draw 0-0. And who knows? Who knows what could happen?
And it would be against all the odds, because it would be absolutely, the 12th game in 35 days, I think, something like that. It's a nonsense. They had so many games called off with several COVID outbreaks in their camp and, you know, rearranged fixtures and stuff. So they've had, you know, there was a week a few weeks back where they played 4 games in 8 days. They have had an absolute, they've had it really tough. So if they do stay up, that is a great story.
Gregor, just quickly, what else should we look out for on the final weekend in the EFL?
The Championship's decided, obviously. We know Norwich and Watford are up, and Brentford, Swansea, Bournemouth, Barnsley in the playoffs. So in League One, it's just the playoffs as well. Relegation is decided. So Blackpool, Sunderland and Tom's Mob, Lincoln, are already decided in the playoffs. And then there's one place, either Portsmouth, Oxford or Charlton.
Who are you going for?
Who am I going for? Portsmouth have got a point more than the other two, and they're playing Accrington. I believe that they will probably nick it, and the Curley brothers will have done a pretty impressive job to reinvigorate Portsmouth's season. I think we should give a quick mention to Wigan, who, after everything that they've been through this year, you know, fire sale of all the players, loss of the manager, new ownership, they look dead and buried at one point, and they're safe with a game to play. That's a remarkable achievement. And in League Two, 4 points separate the top four. This is probably the tightest of all. Only Cheltenham are promoted. Cambridge and Bolton can join them with a win, but Morecambe in fourth place behind them can overtake both of them. And none of the playoff places are decided. So we've still got Newport, Tranmere, Forest Green, Exeter and Salford all need points to hope to make the playoffs on the final day. So lots of drama still in store.
If you're not enthusiastic about the Champions League final, the League Two promotion race, that's where the party's at.
If we're talking on Monday and a goalkeeper has not scored a 97th minute goal to either keep their team in the league or win a title or get promoted or whatever it is, then I will be severely, severely disappointed. So that's what I'm looking out for in the EFL this weekend. That's what it's all about. Just finally, before we go, I wanted to talk to you about the topic of fans. Home fans now will be attending the final two games of the Premier League season, either 10,000 fans or 25% of the full capacity, whichever is lowest. And for me, I thought maybe this was going to be a little bit unfair, whether it skewed the competition. For example, Fulham, they'll go to Old Trafford, they'll face 10,000 fans in their penultimate game, then they host Newcastle on the final day of the season, of course, at Craven Cottage. Yes, it's their home fans, but it's a far lower number, and of course, they will be the only team that goes to Old Trafford with fans all season, pretty much. West Ham, they visit West Brom, then they get to host Southampton on the final day, where their home fans could make a huge difference to a place in the top four or five, whatever they most need. Jonathan, firstly, before we talk about whether it skews the competition, should this have just generally waited until the start of next year?
The competition's been skewed from the start. So, no, I think if we're going to have fans at the cup finals and we're going to have fans at the Euros, there's been supporters waiting for so long to get into the stadiums. I'm quite relaxed about it. And I think the numbers we're talking about are so small that... To me, it's not going to skew very much at all. You can say we've had a year where football competition hasn't been normal because of COVID, and this is maybe another detail. But I don't think it's a massive one. I think public safety and health is actually the forefront of this, not the sport and integrity thing. And if it's you know, safe for people to be back in stadiums and we can do it in game, do it.
You mentioned the playoffs, Hugh, and I must say that. As much as I've been desperate to return to watch my beloved Lincoln City, the idea of doing so as we reach the playoffs is a frightening prospect, and one that I'm left me thinking, can we just park this, please, until next season? But I would say that, without wanting to do too much Lincoln bias, there is a point about it. If the season ended now, we would be playing Sunderland in the playoffs. If fans are to return for the playoff games, then Sunderland will visit Lincoln and have to face 4,000 of our fans who'll make so much noise, I'm sure, that it'll feel like a 50,000 capacity. But there is a genuine point that with the size of the Stadium of Light, we would then be playing against Sunderland with 10,000 of their fans. And I know quite a few Sunderland fans, and I'm sure they'd be very nervous and very fretful about the prospect of playing in the playoffs as well. So your question has merit, is all I'm saying, because even in just that example, there is a little bit of unfairness, should we say. But I mean, the playoffs are a bit of a write-off. I don't think any fan of any club in the playoffs is going to want to be there. Such is a terrifying prospect. But I think ultimately you have to say that if this is a step on the pathway to fans returning overall, then it's worth taking it, as much as I'll be terrified.
It's two games. Unless we're doing this to sort of show how many more games we can host during the Euros, maybe there's a bit of politics in it. I don't know, because I just feel like, you know, if I use the example of one team having to play at Old Trafford against 10,000 fans, look, the players themselves, Gregor, have spoken about when there were 2,000 fans, what a difference it was for that short period that we had 2,000 fans, what a boost it was. And all I'm saying is, for certain teams, that could, you know, Anfield, for example, with even 10,000 fans, that could be massive for Liverpool in those final games where they need points.
No, I agree. I mean, I've not been to a game where it's like that. I remember Alison saying that she was at Craven Cottage and it was remarkable that, you know, even though there was only a couple of thousand fans, that they really did sort of invigorate Fulham. My instinct would be that it wouldn't be so bad even if I was an away player. I just think the fact that there's anyone there would be a boost. You know, they can also be getting their teams back. You know, we've seen that plenty of times. So, yes, there is a bit of unfairness here, but I kind of tend to agree with Johnny in that this season has been like no other, and teams, as we've said, have had to play with kind of half their team out with COVID or cram fixtures in here, there and everywhere. I think if it kind of is a step on the path towards normality, then let's just take it.
Okay, well, we will be taking it. Look forward to the fans coming back in their hundreds or thousands, depending on the size of your home ground, of course. Look, finally, before we go, very quickly, you know, we've got the prequel coming up to the Champions League final this weekend. Manchester City hosting Chelsea in the Premier League. Does anyone think anyone, Tuchel or Guardiola, is going to play their hand in terms of the Champions League final, or will we see a raft of changes? Because, of course, Chelsea need the points.
I'm looking forward to a massive Pep bluff. Just do something really weird. Play 4-4-2 with Aguero and Jesus, or, you know, finally stick Edison up front. Pep, this is your chance. Give me what I've wanted all season. Play Edison outfield. Just do something really weird. Mess with everyone's minds. That's what I'm looking for. The Pep Guardiola bluff.
Do you think they'll play second teams in the Premier League this weekend, Johnny?
No, they won't. I mean, City want to win the league. They want to win it in style. Because of the fixture postponement of United, then they'll play a strong team, I'm sure. And Chelsea need the points. So I think they have to show their hands.
I think it matters, actually. I think, you know, if Chelsea win again, then that's, you know, that'll be twice that Tuchel's got a one over on Guardiola in his short time in the Premier League. And, you know, that would undoubtedly, no matter who you are, that would play on your mind ahead of the Champions League final. So I think there's actually quite a lot riding on this.
No, Man City will still win the league whether they lose at the weekend, and it'll be all about winning the Champions League final. They've only got to win one game, basically, out of the two they've got to play, and that one is the one in Istanbul, or, you know, at Hampden Park, if the case may be. Jonathan Norcroft, Gregor Robertson, Tom Clark, thank you so much for being with me for the past hour or so, and thank you too for listening. We'll talk about that game between City and Chelsea on Monday, but remember, if you enjoy the podcast, leave us a 5-star review wherever you get your podcast from, and of course, remember to subscribe to The Times and The Sunday Times digitally right now. Just go online, search thetimes.co.uk/thegame. You will get yourself 1 month free right now, and of course you can get it across all of your devices. Thanks once again for being with us on The Game. See you on Monday.
VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on. Settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books. Contacts. Calendar. Double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility. There's more to iPhone.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.